Okay, good to have everybody back. It's really good to be here. I had a nice rest in the ER this afternoon, so I'm all ready to go. Just checking for a blood clot, and it turned out negative on that, so very happy. I want to just introduce a little bit of China history with you, just to maybe give you an idea how sometimes God, just like with Israel, you know, for 600 years from the time of Daniel when they were taken into captivity. We've talked about the scattering of Israel all over those four great empires that God raised up over those centuries. He's preparing for Paul's ministry and the apostles being sent out and the hearts of people being ready and the Gentiles coming into those synagogues that were built when they were scattered all over those different nations. So I hope, you know, when you study prophecy that you get a big picture of just how great our God is and how He plans ahead, and you can't comprehend sometimes what God is working at the time that He's working it. When you look at China, in the last, one point of my lesson this morning, in a small individual and weak individual was a man named Doubting Thomas. And you think about going down in history as Doubting Thomas. You know, that's an incredible marking that he has to bear for that. And you find a couple of other times in Jesus' ministry where Jesus is trying to tell him that Lazarus, you know, was sick and he's actually died. And so we're going to go toward Jerusalem. And the apostles knew when you get close to Jerusalem now, it's going to be tough. You know, you're going to be sure death if you go up there. And Thomas just says, oh, let's go die with him. You know, very pessimistic, you know, not much hope in Thomas even then. It was in the presence of the disciples in John 14 at the Last Supper, right before they went to the Mount of Olives and the arrest, that Jesus talks about he's going to make a place for them and I'm going away and you know where I'm going and you know the way, he said. And Thomas said, Lord, we don't know where you're going. We don't know the way. You know, so that's the three times we know about Thomas. But yet, there was a book written about Thomas in 200 A.D. So what I'm going to tell you has, you know, no biblical foundation. It was written 200 years too late. But it tells the story of what people thought about Thomas at that time. And he's supposedly responsible for going to India and teaching the gospel there, and died a martyr about 72 A.D. in the country of India. And we learn later from Eusebius, who was a church historian, a Christian historian, who wrote about the early days of Christianity and all the different beliefs and things that happened, even some of the background of the Bible days, writing the history of it. He records that Thomas even went into China. So that's very interesting. And you also learn that, since I've been going to China since 1991, there's been a great big, like, stone monument that was discovered in the earth. And that they uncovered that and read it. It was from 600 A.D., and it's a monument honoring the Christians who came there, and even the emperor was converted at that time in Xi'an, the area of Xi'an, sort of in the middle where the soldiers are, you know, the ones carved out of stone. And the emperor, when he died, he made secure his grave, okay? They, you know, and so they had about 10,000 soldiers carved out. Every single face is different on those carvings. And it was buried under the ground for years and years. But there was evidence now that Christianity was there in 600. Where they came from, we don't know. But then you take Marco Polo. Most remember that name from your study of European history. Marco Polo went from Italy all the way to Hangzhou, China, where I started church in 1993. And he wrote in his journals as he went. He was, of course, from the Catholic Church. And he wrote in his journal that there were already believers in Jesus in China in 1300 A.D., And then when we come forward, as far as modern Christianity in China, when Columbus discovered that you could take a route to the west and hit land, he was heading to China. He was trying to find a short way to China, ran into America. And so as he went in that direction, later the Spaniards and the Portuguese and the French and the British and later the Americans, when they became a country, all went over to China to do trade. And they staked their claim. And they had the superiority of the gunboats and the large boats and so forth. And they came up the rivers of China and sort of took control of things as they went inland. There was trouble because the traders from the West, they came to trade and they wanted goods from China. But China says, we don't need anything you have. So there was a trade imbalance. And Western powers actually went down to Vietnam, grew opium, brought it back, sort of gave it away in China and got them addicted, and then made their trade and got the trade imbalance off. And you ever heard the term the opium wars? Okay, well, people in China were very upset with the way they were being manhandled by people from the West. They had the gun control and the river control and the coastal control of their nation, and then the trade with opium coming in. So there was a rebellion. There were eight different nations, including Japan, sort of jumped in with the seven other Western nations to sort of divide up. Beijing was divided into eight different sections, and Shanghai was divided into eight different sections between Western nations. So they put up with that in the 1800s. So when you think about some kind of suspicion and hatred about the West, you have to understand a little bit about the history of how their country was sort of taken over. Of course, Japan occupied the northern part of China before World War II and into World War II. Right, now, when you had the Opium Wars, and there was a called Boxer Rebellion. Boxer Rebellion, just a group of people that were going to get the Westerners out. And of course, one of the interesting things is those ships that brought trade, who came on those ships also? Christian missionaries. They came there to spread the gospel, but they were associating with these people who were pillaging their nation. And so when there was war that broke out against the Westerners, well, then there were actually 3,000 Christians, Western Christians, killed in the Boxer Rebellion about 1900. Okay, so there's been a conflict there. Now, if you can look at, there was always upheaval. They had emperors until about the turn of the century, about 1900. But they've been at war for 100 years. You might remember a few years ago, Hong Kong went back to China. Remember that, 1997? Remember that? How'd that all come about? How did England get a hold of Hong Kong? Well, part of the treaty of the Opium Wars and the Boxer Rebellion to get peace was you back up, get out of the rivers, bring your boats out, get rid of the opium trade. You can have Hong Kong, you can have Macau. Portugal got Macau, so they sort of divided up pieces, dots on the map. And so there was a treaty signed that would last 100 years. Britain would have Hong Kong. So Britain honored that treaty in 1997 and gave Hong Kong back to communist China. No one would have known when they made the treaty that it would be like it is today. All right, so if I can describe China to you in 1949 to 1980, think of North Korea today. Seen the pictures? Have you taken ever notice? Have you ever seen, it's a dictator, and he's like a god. Everything he says goes. And even if you're in his cabinet, it's like the old Persian kings, if you don't agree with me, off with your head. If I make a law, it sticks. Type of thing. And so Mao was like that, Chairman Mao. He was a communist leader. After World War II was over, after we dropped the bomb on Japan, and Japan got out of, they defeated Japan and kicked them out of North China. The two groups of people, the nationalists, which later went to Taiwan, and the communists under Mao. Mao won the battle, and then when he took over and came down to Shanghai, he kicked every Westerner out of China. Gone. Absolutely gone. And anybody that had any help to them or given help to them, they were in trouble if they didn't go. The United States offered help to those that had worked, and their secretaries and people under them in the government and the war situation. But many of them said, oh, it'll be fine, we'll be trusted. And so Anyway, Mao comes in, he takes over, and he gets all the peasants that had followed him and got him control of the country. And all the people that have education, have some wealth, it's taken away, and the peasants move in and take over the country. So that's what happened in 1949. Daryl was born 2 weeks before the nation of China, the modern nation, began. Now, immediately Mao kicked all the, like I said, all the Westerners, so all the missionaries. There were big, tall steeple churches built in the 1910, 20, 1930s in Shanghai. In fact, many places in China, there were orphan homes. There were hospitals. There were seminaries set up by foreign missionaries. There weren't that many Christians in China, however. There were maybe still less than 2 million and when 1950 came around. But when Mao came in, he pretty much, he closed down, after 1 or 2 years, he completely shut down all religion in China, tried to. So all the buildings were locked up, Communist Party took them over, they used them as warehouses, whatever they wanted to do with them. All the Westerners were gone, missionaries and so forth. The Christians in China had to go underground. They had to hide, keep it secret. Bibles were confiscated. It got worse and worse and worse as time went by into the 1960s and 70s. Just to give you an idea of some contact I had, I'll show you a picture later of a lady who was in prison for 7 years. Her English name is Mary. She doesn't speak English, but her English name is Mary. Took it after the mother of Jesus, of course. She spent 7 years in prison for being a Christian. They poured scalding hot water down her throat to try to get her to renounce Jesus. When I entered China in 1991, Bibles were still illegal. You carried them in your luggage and they found them, you were sent home. And they hand searched your luggage many times because they didn't have all the scanners and things like that at that time. So the first 2 years, you know, we really had to be concerned about getting caught going right in. Very nerve-wracking. A lot of prayer offered by a lot of people as we entered China. I've had 15 co-workers arrested in China and can't go back. So there is a danger in 21, 24 years of work. I've been in trouble 4 times in the times I've been there and knew I was being watched and followed and escaped. Last time was about 2009. So there's always need for prayer. Things change, and we'll try to talk about some of those changes tonight. Let me see. I need to explain to you a little bit about the state church. When China, communists first took over, they established a religious bureau over Buddhism, Islam, and 2 branches of Christianity, Protestant and Catholic. Now in China, if you talk about the 2 branches, they will say there's Christian and there's Catholic. So the people that don't know about Christianity at all, or Christian history, or whatever the names are, they will say, are you a Christian or are you a Catholic? And not Protestant. Okay, so that's, you have to understand that's what they mean when they're using that term. Alright, so after about a year though, Mao just shut it down completely. All religion. And they were persecuted. Buddhism, Islam, everybody was persecuted. Christians went underground, but, you know, you would have situations like this. In the 1970s, when Mao was kind of losing power among his own people, Mao decided to take hold of the young people in the high schools and so forth and brainwash them and turn them into pawns of his. And he took control of the education system, and it was just total, Mao is your god. Your father and your mother are old and they don't know what they're doing. They're bound to tradition. Our nation's going to just crumble because of this, so you've got to turn on your mom and dad. Rat on them. Tell them what they're saying at home. Tell them what you're doing. So a lot of kids actually went in against their parents. It's an amazing story. I would encourage you to get some books. There's one, even for teenagers, there's a really good book about the Red Guard. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures. They were a little red band. They would go down the streets. And let me tell you how that worked. There was a young man I met in 1991, my first trip. He was 40, I was 42, so I say young man, he was my age at that time. All right, his story. He met one of my friends at English Corner. And here's his story. When he was a boy, his father was arrested because he was simply a professor at a university. He was an educated person. They broke his legs. His mother had to go and tend to him in the hospital. Healthcare is not that great there. You have to go basically tend to your own kin while they're in the hospital. They get some doctor help, but you have to go do the bedpans and all that stuff. You have to serve them. So his mother is with the dad. He's left with a neighbor, this 10-year-old boy. His name's Peter. Got his name later from us. But Peter, he goes to school. And because his dad is an educator, he has to wear a dunce cap. None of the children are supposed to talk to him because of his family background. He's spat at and made fun of. And so he goes to his teacher one day, "What can I do where I'll be treated better?" So you have to join the revolution. You have to show that you're loyal to the government. Your dad's already in trouble, and you're going to be in trouble too if you don't join in and do something to show your loyalty. Now, he knew that Bibles were illegal. He knew that was Western. That was considered a Western book in China. When I had to go first and teach in China, one of the things, the Bible's a Western book, they thought. So I had to use the Chinese character lesson to say, "Look, your people believe the same stories written in the Bible. The Bible's written in Hebrew, not English. This is just a translation like Chinese is a translation of the Bible." But anyway, he lived with this lady, very kind Christian lady. She had a Bible hidden behind her bookcase. She could get it out and read it at night. He knew where it was. He even picked it up one time himself and looked at it. Of course, 10-year-old boy, and he didn't understand. But he knew that would get her in trouble and show his loyalty to what the Red Guard and all the students would just go down the street, enter your house, look for any magazine from the West, anything that's old in Chinese culture that's not what Mao likes. And they would, if they found something, they would take the whole in contents of that house out in the street and burn it. Or even kill the person. Take them in to have a trial. Well, he told the Red Guard, high school kids, thugs, brainwashed people, about this woman's Bible. They went in and found it, carried all her stuff out, and burned it in the street. Then he realized just what he had done, and he, of course, cried and didn't know what in the world to do. But he made a promise at that moment. If he ever had a chance again, he would read that Bible. 30 years later, my friend meets him at English Corner and gives him a Bible. He becomes a Christian, became a leader of the church in Shenyang, China. That's what China went through, like North Korea is going through right now. Peter explained to me, he says, in China you're either a policeman or you're a prisoner. And what he meant by that is, if you don't turn your neighbor in and rat on them and police them and get them in trouble, then you'll get in trouble and you'll be in prison. That generation, the young people that I met in 1991, their parents would not talk to them about what happened back there. Why? Not only were they mistreated, but they did mistreat other people. It was a godless, terrible situation. You can imagine what ISIS is like. Live in Iraq or a place like that. That was basically what was happening in China. Just terrible times. Mao had crazy policies that just bankrupt the country, and 100 million of his own people were either killed politically or starved to death in the 1960s. Just unfathomable. There's a book called Life and Death in Shanghai, written by a Chinese lady that got away to America. It's well worth reading. I just about required the ones I took in the first 10 years to read that book, because she writes it for an American audience, and she explains all the culture. So you learn a lot just about the culture of China when you read that book and tell about what happened in those days. Okay, when Mao died, about 1980, they changed their political leanings. They'd had a spat with Russia about a border up to the north. And Nixon had sent, you know, ping pong diplomacy. You remember that? They sent some ping pong players to America to go get beat up over there playing ping pong. Okay. But it was the first step to try to establish some type of contact with the country. Eventually, the new leader, after Mao died in about 1980, he began to look, find ways to improve their economy, and he looked for, let's try a little bit of capitalism. And so he set up a new city next to Hong Kong, inside the border. Remember, Hong Kong was still British, but he set up a city right next to Hong Kong, built it from a fishing village. By the time I got there in 91, 11 years later, 2 million people lived there, and there were tall buildings, 18, 20 stories high, and just the hustle and bustle. It was a model to show the world that what China can do. Come in and invest in your factories, and people from all over China would come to that city to meet foreigners and try to do business. I went there and did, there was just a place of 500 people gathered on Sunday just to practice English. All of them 20 to 25 years old. I read in National Geographic magazine that same place. The reporter that wrote that article went to the same place I went to. I got to speak to 500 people in 1990 at that place. Baptized 8 people that I met that day. But that man in his article said the average age in that city of 2 million people was 25 years old. And there were no children. All single people, just about seeking their fortune. When persecution arose up in Xinjiang, the church had to flee for their life. One of the Christians fled to Shenzhen, and there was a border around that city. Not all Chinese could even get in. You had to have special permission to get in. Well, he snuck in, and he got, you know, job, restaurant, whatever, to get away from his hometown. That's how the church in Shenzhen got started and why I went there. Because there was 3 different individuals in 1 year either moved there for business or ran because of persecution. Now, when they opened up, they began to invite Westerners to teach English at universities. When I first went into Shenyang in 1991, there was a U.S. consulate there, Jeff and Anna Kingery. Anna took a job at the U.S. government to teach school at some consulate or somewhere in the world. They prayed to God and asked, okay, let God and the U.S. government choose where we go. So they wound up in Shenyang, China. They wanted to go for the sake of the gospel. They wound up there. They learned about English Corner. They learned that there was enough people speaking English to keep you busy, even though you didn't know the language. They lasted 6 months. Our government kicked them out because they found they were out teaching people the Bible while they were there. But they learned enough that got me interested to go in. Now, this opened up to the West. And as business got bigger and more businesses came, my work has gotten easier. Because, see, when we first went, they'd search you all over. They would assign a plainclothes policeman to every single foreigner that came in the country. So I had, the first 2 years, I had plainclothes policemen following me. You go, first time I ever noticed it, okay? I went downstairs in my hotel. Of course, in the hotel, they had only one hotel in the city can house a foreigner. And when you go to that hotel to get the room, they choose your room for you. Why? Because they got you bugged. They're going to listen to all your conversations and so forth. That's how I lost 12 pounds my first trip, and it wasn't because of the food. It was just pure out stress. And not so much stress for myself, safety, but for the Chinese, because they have to live there. They can't go away. I mean, they're not going to kill me. They would send me home. But by 94, in contrast to me and the companion I was with in 91 in Shenyang, we were, besides the ones in the consulate, just a few families, a few people there in the consulate, there were 2 other women in that city, a foreigner. They were little missionaries teaching English from an Assembly of God. I did meet and had dinner with the entire Harlem Globetrotters basketball team. We registered at the embassy to make sure we were, people knew we were there. We got there, okay? So the embassy would at least know, so if something happened, they would know we arrived. So we registered, and 3 or 4 days later, they left a post on our hotel door inviting us to a banquet. And we were sure wanting a banquet by then. And then I got to go and sit down with what used to be, in my day and time, Metal Lark Lemon was the comic, right, and on that team. And so I sat down next to the comic guy at lunch and had a great time and had lots of good food at the consulate. And I had that man offer me $100 for my jar of peanut butter I'd brought with me. And I wouldn't sell it to him for $200 if he'd asked. Because I really needed that. I had another 20 days. You can imagine those athletes playing every night. And not having the meat and everything you normally would expect. Well, I've talked a lot about it. I'll show you some pictures here in just a minute. But this will give you some idea about what it was like. Yes?
How long did you go?
Well, it used to, there was a 30-day visa. And you could probably, if you had a business, like somebody's coming in to Microsoft or, you know, Ford or something like that, you could get longer if you had a business situation, getting a factory started. But 30-day tourist visa is what I used. Of course, the English teachers, you went in there as an English teacher, you could stay for a year, special setup for you. So you could go as an English teacher, but what I did actually was more free. If you worked for the university, you were very tightly controlled about, you know, who came to your room and they'd watch you and that type of thing. I eventually worked a lot with those, you know, American teachers that were there. Some of them from Harding and Abilene Christian that I met on occasion. But see, I was free. I was like a tourist, and I would come in. I could stay for a few days, not cause too much of a scene. And I could actually go to English Corner, meet people, and then give the person who's interested to the English teacher there. Christian is an English teacher. And they could follow up a little better. But I could find them by being a little more open. And my hotel room was flooded with people. After that first couple of years, I told you about the bugs in the room and the policemen following you. After 93, that disappeared. They didn't do it to every foreigner. They would send someone on you if you caused them a reason. And I certainly had people follow me later on when things got too hot. I was, you know, getting too many people coming and drew attention somehow or another. And so I had to watch for it all the time. But it was not an automatic thing when you entered the country after 93. So that made it a lot easier for me. And then as the numbers of foreigners, just to give you an idea of what the change is, that in Shanghai today, there's over probably 200,000 foreigners in Shanghai. And used to, when you walk down the street of Shanghai, even people would just drop their jaw and stare at my big nose. In Shenyang, China, I'd go out of my hotel and walk down the street, and of course it was all bicycles. Nobody owned a car at that time. I'd walk down the street, and all those bicycles just one after one, you know, handlebar to handlebar, you know, 15 deep, 30 deep, thousands of people on the street. And all of a sudden, when one went down, all of them, 100 people. And it happened every time I went out, and I realized, I'm causing this. Because somebody, you know, would be looking at like that, you know, and it would run. And I saw a guy hit a light pole one day, just right beside me. He just blew himself away. He was all right, actually. But. So it's kind of felt guilty about even leaving the room. So, any other question real quick while we're stopped for questions? Yeah. Just oral English. I'll show you a picture here in a minute of one of those. But let me explain how it worked. The Russian was the main second language in the 60s and 70s. And then when that incident happened, and the new leader turned toward the West, then they started pushing English in the universities. The students were really wanting to do it for two reasons. Number one, you can get a better job with a new economy. A foreign company come in, you can get a job with them. Or you can, China was letting people come to America, study and learn engineering, learn science, all this stuff, and bring it back to China, right? And of course, they were spies were sent out too. But But the truth is, they wanted to learn English. And these students were very highly motivated because it was a ticket to freedom for some of them, a lot of them. Get out of here and go abroad to study. The people that I've baptized in China, there are now Chinese people that I've taught Jesus Christ in 14 different countries. All the way from, you know, Australia, England, Canada, any place English is spoken, they've headed. Some of them even went into Germany, and, you know, places like that, to get jobs and go to school in the state, that type of thing. I've had a lot of contact in the U.S. from when they get here. I'll get set up to teach in some situations. So anyway, on English Corner was, just put it, you go to the city park. At that time, there's like only one per city of like 10, 20 million. They'd all come and gather on usually Sunday morning. And you know where it is, and you would go there. And then it might have groups of 10, 5, 20 over here, depending on maybe the Chinese person and their ability. And it wasn't organized at all. You just know to go there and chat. And it turned into a dating scene. A bunch of single college kids. You know, this is a place where it's at. Everybody speaks English, and you can have a good time and maybe find a boyfriend or a girlfriend. It was quite a scene. And then when a foreigner, especially in 39, shows up, all those little groups just flock like flies to the foreigner. So you're like a celebrity when you walk up. You can't preach. There's always a government agent. They'll be plain clothes. So you have to be careful what you say. Wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove. What my purpose is to make friends. My purpose is to give out my phone number at the hotel and room. Give me a call if you want to take me somewhere and show me a tourist thing, or if you want to come and practice English, I will go. I'll take you out to lunch or something. They will take me. I said, I'll joke them. They take me to lunch. But anyway, out of an English corner, you might have five or six calls come. And when they come to your room, they'd usually bring another person, especially a lady. If they wanted to come, they'd bring another person. And sometimes three or four might come in. But by the time you've been there for 10 days, you've met 40 people that have come in and studied Bible with you. Amazing situation. And I don't use English Corner much anymore. Once you get a church started, you convert people from that in a matter of days. They bring people, their friends. And so you don't really depend on that anymore. And now there's so many foreigners that you really don't stand out at English Corner. And they've got English teachers in every university in China. Several, probably. So that I don't need that, and it's not... It's fun, and I would recommend that somebody, you know, if you went over there as a tourist, to find it and go, and you'll enjoy it a lot. It's like, it reminds me of Mars Hill in Athens in the Bible, where they talk about anything, all kinds of questions and theories, and they'll throw things at you. They'll ask you all kinds of questions. It's always interesting. You can't go there. You don't want people to know you're, you know, come there to preach the gospel. So they're going to ask you, though, why'd you come to China? Well, I came to see your country. I'm going to meet the people. What do you do for a living? I'm a teacher. Or I might use this approach. Why do you come to China? Well, I come to China to teach Chinese people how to use chopsticks. And they go, ha! We all know how to use chopsticks. I said, well, I'm a good teacher. So it just sort of, I don't have to tell a lie or anything, but just joke, and it goes on. And if they marry me into a corner, you know, I would tell while I'm there. If they ask me if I'm a Christian, I say, yeah, I'm a Christian. Just, you know, they're not going to arrest you because if you're a foreigner, especially after 93, they're not going to arrest you just because you're a Christian. You're from America, and they think everybody's a Christian in America. You know, 70% of us say we are, you know. The truth is, let's give you a statistic for a moment. 1991, it was estimated there were 2 million people who believed in Jesus Christ in China. 2 million. Out of 1.4 billion people. That's way less than 1%. Way less. Let's come forward to today. 100 million Chinese people are believers in Jesus. Let me explain something to you. There are now more people that attend church every single week in China. Either house church, illegal, or an open state church. There are more people that attend church in China on Sunday than there are in this country right now. Because why? 70% say they believe, but 15% of those that are Christians attend church regularly. Whereas in China, people are pretty dedicated to it. They pay a price for it. Let me go in the back with a question and come back to you. Yeah. Beliefs. Okay, good question. Okay. Are there all these different denominations like we have here? The answer is no, in the sense that, well, when I first came, you know, I was the only show on in town, okay, so the only Bible teacher. And it was so wonderful just to present Jesus and not have to deal with all the ism and this ism and, you know, all of that mess that comes along with it. But it wasn't long. People got over there just like I got over there. And I'm even the ones that were there underground for those 30 or 40 years, they had, you know, everything you find here sometimes in them. But as far as their thinking, this is what's different about China right now. In their own thinking, they're just a Christian. They don't have the organizations, they don't have the networks, they're that type of thing. So they just look at themselves as Christians. And they believe in Jesus. And yes, some of them have been sprinkled. Well, a good portion have been sprinkled. There was a great influence from England, Church of England situation. Methodist, I guess, from England came over in the 1800s. And that, you know, they built buildings. Those are the ones that were kicked out in 1949. So the, whatever they were teaching, the Protestant denominations. And there's a Catholic, it's very interesting when the communists took over and they formed the state bureau over religion. And they formed one over the Catholic Church. One of the things is, it's called the three-self church. You have to be self-funded. In other words, you can't get any funds from the West. You can't take anything outside, which, you know, fine. You have to be self-governing or self, no Western influence, no Western head, no religious body somewhere. Okay, what does that do to the Pope? All right, so the Catholics in China cannot honor the Pope. You can't use that. So their bishops that they have in the even the underground Catholic Church are not the ones that Rome would pick necessarily. And it's very interesting. What happened in 1962 in the Vatican was Vatican II. Remember all the changes and they began to do the Mass in English instead of Latin? That happened in my lifetime. That didn't happen in China because they're not under the Romans. They still did the last Mass in Latin in 1991. Nobody went. Even though they were opened up, the building, some of them had opened up, nobody went to the state church. Why? Everybody was scared to death. Back in Mao's day, Mao would encourage you to speak out, criticize the government, help us do better. All right, you would speak up. Okay, they'd have your name. And when they wanted to crack down, there you were and you were gone. That happened over and over. You learn after a while. So when the government says, you can come to these buildings now, it's fine. Nobody can. All right. So that was a long time. But it's changed. The state churches hold several services a day, both Protestant and Catholic. The people in line, they hold them Saturday, all day Saturday and Sunday. And they're building new buildings. I'll show you some. Another thing that's changed, in the 90s, the preacher at the state church had the state over him. He kept his job because he complied with all the state rules and regulations. There's some things you cannot speak about, like abortion. You can't preach against abortion. That's birth control in China. You got the one-child policy. Everybody has one child. How do you not have more than one child? You abort the second one. Government enters the womb every month. They give you a test to see if you're pregnant. If you're pregnant, you have an abortion. It's not a matter of whether it's right or wrong, or who's in charge or whatever, who gets to make the decision or choice. It's forced upon you. You can run, you can hide. That's what it's like. But the preachers, you speak against it, lose your job. All right? Second coming. There's a lot of stuff, Revelation. The book of Revelation is taboo in the state church. Why? Because Christians have misused Revelation to predict the end of the world. It causes farmers and people to quit their jobs and not plant their crops. It happened right here in America. The whole Seventh-day Adventist and Jehovah's Witness movement started with wrong predictions. 50,000 people in New England did not plant their crop 2 years in a row when William Miller began his teaching. They're still here. It's amazing. There's cults in China that do the same thing even now. So you can understand a little bit their reasoning. I think the Chinese government would be proud to have me come and teach if they knew, understood what I teach about that, about the dating of the event. But anybody else have a question? I'm sorry? Okay. I'm sorry, I did not hear you. They battle back and forth. The Catholic Rome tries to get into China, and they still haven't come to an agreement. I think they're getting a little closer to letting the Catholic Church have some say in who gets to be a bishop in China. Yeah. Tiananmen Square? 1989. It was 2 years before I got there, and it was very much a big issue for me and my work. See, the Kingrys were there in 88 when they went to Shenyang. And there was trouble immediately because some of the people he converted, I mean, we're talking about when you converted a student, they're some of the most elite people in China. They're either there because they're communist members, their father's a bigwig, has the money and the power to get them in school. Or they're extremely, extremely smart. The people I taught the gospel to first, you know, their IQ was way above mine. Now, they may have a second language, English. But sometimes you talk down to them because you have to slow down and talk English. But they're brilliant people. But 89 was, yeah, they wanted capitalism, they wanted freedom of the press, that type of thing. And it got out of control. Some of the leaders in China were okay with it. Some were saying no. They had a big fight inside the Communist Party about it. The soldiers that went to Beijing, the Beijing soldiers were there the whole time, the ones in Beijing, at Tiananmen Square. There were 1 million people gathered and just camped out there with their Statue of Liberty and all that. And when the people got, the soldiers would not have dared open fire. The ones that had been there the whole time in Tiananmen Square, because it was peaceful as it could be. But they got people from Shenyang. They were getting the government approach on TV about what was going on. They're hoodlums, they're troublemakers, and that type of thing. So the soldiers from Shenyang come down. They get the tanks. They march through. You've seen the pictures about the Chinese guy standing in front of the tank, you know, stopping a line of tanks. Well, we don't know what happened to him. Nobody does. He's still a mystery who he was. But there were several hundred people killed that day. We saw it live. I mean, I saw it live on CNN. There was people in the hotels around the Tiananmen Square. Some of the converts that Jeff and Anna Kingley made, they were part of that student movement. And they were hot potatoes from then on. So the church in Shenyang had a lot of trouble. And when I went up there, it was hot. And we were watched very, very carefully all the time. But still, great, great things that were done. Let me show a few slides. I know I've talked to almost the whole time now, but I want to see a few pictures for you. This is the old. I want to emphasize to you the way things changed to the new. Just the in 1991, there was not 1 mile of interstate highway in China. Now you can go all over the country on the interstate highway and the loops around the cities and everything. Infrastructure has been built totally brand new. They have a modern subway systems in Beijing and Shanghai and many cities. Shanghai is 20-something million. Beijing is 25 million. There's some snake for dinner. Here's the new modern grocery stores. Old McDonald's. There's your old parking lots. You still see that, but mostly it's motorbikes, not bicycles. There's the old transportation system and trucking industry. Here's your new cars. Now, some of those kids that I taught in 91, they had one set of clothes they wore every day. Might have one change. Now, they drive better cars than I drive, some of them. There's a lot of money in the cities. Not everybody in the city is rich, but it's a lot different situation. The cars are so many. Every single day in Beijing, there's 2,000 more automobiles on the road. They've been increasing auto sales 40% since 1998, every year. There's the old soldiers the emperor had and made. There's the new ones. They put a huge percentage of their GNP in military. Here's the old. Here's the new. That city right there was built in the last 15 years since I've been going. I went to a place that Shenzhen next to Hong Kong. I stayed in a hotel. The tallest building at that time was 18 stories. That's where I taught most of my gospel in Shenzhen. Around that building right now, there are 3 100-story buildings right next to it. I saw them go up. Every time I'd go back, and every night, those cranes would be working outside my window. I'd be sitting there on the 18th floor, and a big old light would blare in my window. There's Mary. By the way, I'm on my knees in that picture. We met Mary when one of the members in Hangzhou went... Oh, I got left something out. 1997 was a great year in my life. Been hauling Bibles in, smuggling Bibles in. I mean, people died actually doing that. 1997, I had a man, I met a young man that became a Christian, and he, in the underground network, he knew people a lot of different places. He eventually translated the Bible from Hebrew into Chinese. And he brought a man to my hotel room in Shanghai, a box of Bibles. Bilingual Bibles, English and Chinese, that thick. He had a job. His job was to distribute those Bibles into the state churches of China. Through them, their bookstore at their building. It would be legal. He gave me a box. He was like a double agent. He traded with the underground church and the state church and got him a Bible. This man that brought books to my room was arrested in 1962, and he stayed in prison until 1980. 18 years. And now he is chosen by the government to distribute Bibles in China. I had the privilege of meeting him. That was one of the happiest days of my life. And here's another stat for you. Anybody know what I mean by Chairman Mao's Little Red Book? In the Communist Revolution, you had to have propaganda lessons every night. Chairman Mao wrote his sayings, just like Confucius wrote his sayings. He had these wise sayings you had to memorize. The propaganda, the communist philosophies of Marx. You would have to attend those meetings. If you didn't attend, you would get in trouble. In fact, you have to have a copy on you as you went down the street. They could ask you. That'd be one thing the Red Guard would look for. You got your little red book with you. If you didn't, they could get you. You know what the most printed book in the world is. The Bible. It's been that way. It's been the number one best-selling book in the world since the printing press. The number two printed book in the world is Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. Now, people didn't buy it. They may have been forced to buy it. I don't know how they did it, whether they gave it out, but they had one. But the factory that printed Chairman Mao's Little Red Book is the exact same place they print the Bibles now. They export Bibles from China to your bookstore locally. Look in your cupboard if you bought a new Bible. It's probably printed in that factory. Just things like that that just show me the little things turning. A great God can turn things upside down. Mary's a little insignificant woman, but yet there's probably thousands of people in China that in some degree owe their salvation to this woman. She wouldn't give up. She wouldn't deny her Lord. She stayed in the countryside. She was carrying two big shopping bags full of Bibles when my Christian friend that I baptized brought her to the hotel room. And Mary came back every single day that week. And I would always make sure when Mary was leaving at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, she'd come in the morning. She'd always come early in the morning. I usually teach till midnight. There's somebody there, whether we're teaching a class or somebody stays for counseling or whatever. I'm up to midnight almost every night. And I would say to Mary when she left at 5, through a translator, of course, "Mary, we start teaching at 10 o'clock in the morning. Look forward to seeing you at 10 o'clock. Mary would knock on my door at 7:30 every morning. Hadn't had breakfast, hadn't shaved, hadn't gotten anything, and I can't even talk to her. There's no translator there. So Mary would sit in my room and read her Bible until somebody came to help out a little bit. But she kept them. She told the stories. She loved Bible. I taught her and another lady that came with her one day about baptism. Mary grabbed my arm to pull me out in the countryside. I said, "Mary, I can't go this time. I've got too much commitment right here already." But you can do it. You can teach it. Because she ate it up. She ate the book of Acts and saw the need. I mean, she baptized already, but she saw the urgency of it when we studied that day. Here's the new. Those little college kids, we taught Jesus Christ before long. They were married and had babies. They taught their parents. Here's our baptistry, hotel bathtub. We have a different one now, very proud of. It's a little baby teaching infant how to swim in your home. It's made out of plastic and has little rods that go down and just pull it out and blow a little bit of air into it and make it stand up a little bit, and then you pour water in it and you just get them on their knees in that water, sit back on their knees and just bow their head like that, and I can push their head down a little bit and they're totally immersed. Very easy compared to what we used to have. Sometimes when you had a man get in the bathtub, you had to use a little engineering. I won't explain all that to you, but I've baptized in the beach. I've baptized in rivers. I've put people in stone jars and water rain catchers. Here's some of the cities that we go. Here's Urumqi or Ulamuchi. Look where it is, way out in the northwest China. I was way over on the other side. I was over here and traveling from Hangzhou to Shanghai on a train with a Christian sister. I taught in Hangzhou for a week and I was headed to Shanghai, and she wanted to go and join in the studies there, so we got the train together. So it was just a few years ago, and 2011 actually. And on that train, we wouldn't have done this earlier, but it's no problem now. We can open our Bible on the train. I don't worry about it. And we had our Bible out studying together. And there was a lady assigned to the seat right there. Now, she had got up when we first started. There was an empty seat, and she got up to have more room. And when the next stop came, she had to come back to her assigned seat. And we had our Bibles out, and she, 2 minutes later, she's digging in her purse, and she brings her little Bible out. And she begins to question my Christian sister there, young lady. And she was asking about me and what I was doing in China. And the lady told her what I was doing, and she said, "He must come to my city." I said, "Mostly Islam where I am, and mostly no Christians hardly at all. And the people that did obey Jesus, they don't have the Bible in their language. We need help." They looked up at me and she told me what she wanted, and I said yes before I even knew where it was. And then when I got home that night to the hotel and got on the internet and looked where this place was, it's a 5-hour plane ride from Shanghai. It's as far as from New York to Los Angeles. It was the expense of that ticket was as high as my trip from the United States to China. And I had to pay for a translator to go with me. But I went. Their language comes from the time of Daniel in Persia, in Iran. Their descendants come from Iran, not from China. They're a minority group in China. It's controlled by China. They don't want to be a part of it. You probably heard in the news that province, they have terrorism, they have a rebellion going on. 2 weeks before I got there, 400 people were killed in that city. Some of the students got upset with the government. They went out and demonstrated. Chinese government said they burned things and so forth, so they came in and just wiped them out. Not like Tiananmen Square, 89. Some of the people from that city, Islamic, came down to the south, down here to, let me see, Kunming. And I was there last year. And I left, and 2 weeks later, at the train station I left from in Kunming, there were 71 people killed as they went into the, at the train station turnstiles where you give your ticket and bring your luggage through, so forth. They just got machetes, about seven of them, and just started killing people. So they've got terrorism in China as well with Islam. Let me tell you something else that will interest you. It really touched the heart of a man in Bowling Green when I told him this, because he's been praying for some way to stop this nonsense called Islam. And it's very difficult for Americans to get into those countries or do much good, just because of the political situation, the hatred, whatever it is. But China has many contacts with these countries. China will go into Africa. They will go into Iran. They will go into places we don't go politically. And they'll say, we will build your infrastructure. We want your minerals or whatever. They do trade. And they send their people in there to build things. And some of those people now are Christians, about probably 6% of them. And there's churches in China right now that say, we're going to convert the Muslim world. Pray for them. Pray for them. There's the father of a Muslim family that he's a professor at the university who is now a Christian. His wife learned it first. Somebody left her a Bible who was an English teacher there. And she read it and decided he was not a prophet. There's right outside the restaurant is a mosque. I was there right at the call of the hour of prayer. The trumpets blowing, everybody facing in one direction. Burqas, two languages, Arabic characters and Chinese characters on the sign. There's the mosque from the back. Here's the group in the hotel room. The minority person who was a Christian was a manager of a 5-star hotel. I don't normally stay in one like that. This room was by far the most expensive room I stayed in. They gave me half price, and it was still the most expensive room I stayed in. But the translator had a room. It was like a big sitting room in the middle and a bedroom on both sides. So she stayed on the other side. That's Shelley from Hangzhou. She was on the train with me right up front there. I've known her. She actually became a Christian in Russia. Her main second language is Russian, but she translates for me. She knows English well enough to translate Bible. I felt so dumb over there. Some of the people around. I can't even speak English well. By the way, I'm kind of proud of it. At English Corner and all, a lot of the Christians, the church started at English Corner. And they practiced their English with me and some of the people I took. And most of us are from Alabama. So they speak wonderful Southern English. But I spent 4 days there just teaching the whole Bible plan. At the last day, somebody spoke up and said, we don't understand much about baptism. And so I taught the afternoon. You asked about other denominations. There's different beliefs. These people have been sprinkled. They didn't understand the importance. But they said, we don't understand. There's all kinds of different things. And so we just got the Bible out. And about 14 of them decided to be baptized out of that group of 40. There's only a few hundred in that city of 3 million. But I sort of had the more mature and the more experienced ones. In this picture, the boy down at the bottom left over here. He actually, I baptized him in another city. He just happened to move there that week. And somebody back east that I knew him and knew I was going here told him, and he showed up. So it's a small world, even in China. That happens very often now. Here's English Corner. People just waiting to hear you talk. And you go up there, and since you can't preach, what I do is I get the conversation going on a spiritual plane, like marriage. What makes you happy? What place does money have in your life? How can you have peace and contentment? How much is enough? How to build relationships? And sometimes I'll refer. You know, I'm a Christian. This is what I would do, that type of thing. And you know, you're not supposed to convert anybody, right? Now, one of the things that changed about my work in China, I'm going to go over to another I want to show you just a couple of things here. One of the things that's changed a lot is I was allowed to begin to go into universities and teach lectures on marriage. And I asked some of the people that were taught in the 90s that were in the classroom as professors, get me an appointment with your dean. And I want to talk to them about the importance in the classroom in China to give a well-rounded education. If you're going to have a good culture and a good civilization, you must have good morals. Young people must be taught how to be a good wife, how to be a good husband, how to be a mother, how to be a father, what's expected. They get none of that. Their parents don't talk about it. The schools don't teach it. They don't have the books we have in the Christian bookstores that we can go and get. First time I went, Christian sister, within, after I told her my plan, in 1 hour, I was sitting in front of the head of the school of 20,000 people. She didn't spend but 10 minutes with me. What she did after she saw a little bit of my PowerPoint, I explained to her, I'm a Christian. I know I can't go and make a lecture that's going to convert people, but I will have some Bible verses on my screen about marriage and about love, what love is and what affection is, and I'll use some principles. Oh, that's fine. That's Western stuff, and we need, you know, they're English. And these are medical students. They're very mature. They're graduate students. Said, whatever Jane wants, talking about the Christian girl that I knew. Whatever Jane wants, we'll do it. I trust him. Came back in January. There's 300 people came to a lecture. I stayed in a hotel room on that campus for about 3 days after that. Not that week, but 5 people that made contact were baptized by the next trip. Now, I got help from Christian brothers and sisters there. They attended actually worship service, came all the way across the city. It took them 2.5 hours to get to where I was usually working at another university around that where the church started. They came that first Sunday and later were converted. And the next time I went to that same university, 1,000 seat auditorium. And they were just stacked on the steps going up in that auditorium. I've done that in about 15 or 20 different universities in China. I could do it more. You have to be able to stay there a while to make it count. I mean, you'll do good by the lecture you do, but to really follow up as far as converting people, you got to stay for a while. So I don't do it as often as I could. Now, I used to avoid going to China during a holiday. 600 million people travel in the same week in China. The trains, the planes, everything is just piled up everywhere you go. But I began to have churches ask me, he says, come during the holiday and we will stay here. We won't go off and we'll just study Bible for a week. And so the whole church will stay all day long, 8 to 8. Have lunch together, supper together, and study the rest of the time. So I've been pretty busy I go the holidays some now, but you get into some trouble like that. That's what you have to go through to get on a train. And that's even outside the building sometimes looks like that, plus what's inside. There's everybody traveling on the holiday. They got to take the people that work on the East Coast sometimes live on the West side of China. They work for 50 weeks in the factory. They go home those 2 weeks around the New Year holiday. Chinese New Year, not ours. Chinese New Year's a moon holiday. It's between mid-January to mid-February. It depends on the moon. So they've got a lot of belongings to take. They only get home once a year. Give you some idea. Here's a family in Yantai, right across from North Korea. Very rich family. I had sea cucumber. That's an animal. That's not a vegetable. Okay. I had that every morning for breakfast. It was very, very expensive, so I had to eat it. But these were members of the state church there, and something's changed. I get invited often now to speak at the state church. Now, in this particular group, they didn't ask me to. They just asked me to come and teach their leaders for a few days, about 12 of them. I did that, but by the time Sunday arrived, they told me Saturday night I was speaking the next morning at the state church. So when I went, they brought me up, and I suspect that I went there at 9 o'clock. I was expecting that they would be starting their singing and so forth, and I'd have a little time to set up and get a feel for the place. No, they'd already been there since 8. When they brought me in at 9, right at 9, it was time for me to walk up and preach. Well, I had to still get my computer set up. I had PowerPoint, stuff like that. So, and then when I got through, somebody came and got me by the arm and took me immediately to the car and took me off. And I suspect they were not wanting the government heads to know that a foreigner had been there, because that was taboo for a long time, may still be in some areas. So I just do what they tell me to do. They know the security in this situation. There's a picture of actually from the back of the church where I preached. There's about 1,000 members. I'm not sure there was that many there that Sunday. Go kind of quickly here. There's a Beijing train station. I took a flight to Beijing from that place, then bus to the countryside, and then later to Jingzhou. The weather, there are no clouds. That is a perfectly clear day weather-wise. That's pollution in Beijing. You can eat it, really. Last year on an interstate near Beijing, people got stranded like this. Everyone ran out of gas, so it took 9 days to get the road open again. It didn't take that long this day when I was there. That's a lot. Picture I took. There's a rest area if you can get in and out. There's no such thing as a no-passing zone in China, especially buses, passing trucks on mountain roads. 50% chance of hitting a falling rock, 45% chance of hitting head-on another 18-wheeler, 4% chance of falling off the cliff on the right side into the river. I'd like to tell you that I was not worried riding on that bus because I believe God was with me. But also I'm a Bible teacher and I know God is wiser than me, and He would definitely not have got on that bus. Here's where I was going, and it was well worth it. Countryside, there was a group of 22 preachers, men and women. There's another difference, okay? There's a lot of differences you got to deal with. You have to take it one step at a time. That's where they live, and that's where they gather. From all over, maybe what we would call a county in Kansas or Colorado or something, they came to study Bible for 4 days. We lived there, ate there, and locked up there. I was not free to go. You've got to be careful because this is way out in the countryside. There's no foreigner in their right mind would go there for any other reason than to teach Jesus Christ. Stir fry for 23. Baking bread, burning coal. This is their bed and where they ate breakfast, and that's the originating of the bed and breakfast that we talk about. American Christians are not the only ones to go to sleep in the church building. We just happen to do it during the preaching. I taught these teachers for 3.5 days, 8 hours a day, and sometimes for 12. They come from many house groups that total almost 3,000 in membership. they had been sprinkled. My lesson I was going to teach this morning on Galatians 4, an allegory between Hagar and Sarah. I used that material with them, and it was based on the Old and New Covenant and the concept of those covenants and how they relate to each other and how to interpret and how to deal with understanding the Bible, basically. One of the points that I have toward the end is that there's two women and there's two covenants and there's two mountains, Sinai and Zion, and there's two Jerusalems, the present-day Jerusalem of Paul, which Hagar represented, and the heavenly Jerusalem, which Sarah represented in that new covenant. But then at some point in that 2:2:2:2, I say there's two circumcisions. And I use the one in Colossians chapter 2. It talks about that we have a circumcision made without hands by Jesus Christ. A circumcision that Jesus Christ performs, and we're buried with Him and by baptism. So I just asked him after we read that verse about that circumcision. It says, do we need to be circumcised today? And they said, well, yes, but it's spiritual circumcision. It's a circumcision made without hands. It's a circumcision that Christ does. But when does Christ cut off the sins of our flesh and perform surgery on us? The sword looked blank and said, read it again and tell me the answer. And they said, baptism. Buried with Christ. They were sprinkling. After that lesson that night, I was told that two of them would be baptized tomorrow. By the time we went to bed, there was 20 said that. They made a baptistry. They made some concrete slabs, set them on their end, and they put a big plastic material, stuffed it down in that hole. And then we baptized them. The beautiful thing, and I'll have to quit, our time's way gone. The beautiful thing about, I've changed what I've been doing. Okay, my work has changed, just like many things in China have changed. I don't start on purpose new churches. That's not really my purpose. I mean, it happens. And I do work with, teach new, you know, people, unbelievers, and I do some of that work. I go and help the congregation sometimes that I help start. There's other people going besides me. But my work now focuses on, I get this invitations like this to go and teach groups of preachers for 3 or 4 days. I don't know what they believe when I go. I don't even ask. I don't really care as long as they've got hearts that are willing to learn. That's what determines whether I go and teach them or not. 3 times since fall a year ago. 3 times when I did this, I had the same result as what you see on the screen. So I think you can see, and when you realize what I'm looking at is that when these people that have 3,000 people that look up to them as leaders, and you see them not only say, okay, I believe what you're teaching, Daryl, they did it. If that person makes that commitment to do it, they're going to go back and they're going to baptize people where they're at. They're going to teach them correctly. I don't know that for sure. I won't go maybe to their church and meet. But I believe I can go back. I've got an invitation everywhere I've been except 2 places. I got kicked out of 2 places. Not everything's smooth, okay? Sometimes you say something. Some of the lessons I would have said here, I got in trouble for some things and got kicked out. But anyway, pray for me. I gave you a little taste about what the work is like and how it's progressing and what my work is. I'll take a couple of more questions, okay? I don't want to leave you without giving you a chance if you want to do that. Yes?
Church is set up, they have elders and a preacher?
A lot of them are pastor system, you know, like some of the denominations here. Some have elders, that's for sure.
I notice a lot of the pictures.
Okay. Here's the thing that I haven't mentioned, but from day one, even the churches I started are 80 to 90% women. It's just something about the culture. The men are really hard-nosed, and they're very I-know-it-all type mentality. The women are very submissive. The women are very serving type people. And I'm generalizing. You know, there's both are not true in some cases,
right?
But that's just the way it is. It's in all the churches I've seen. Others started. It's in the ones that we've helped to start, and it causes a lot of problems and difficulties because of that. But the good part is, the women here and the way we look at women sometimes, we need to stop it. We've got valuable, valuable people in our midst that are women. They have incredible, and you look at the ministry of Jesus and the number of women that ministered to Him, even gave to His needs physically, brought people to Him. I suspect that even if you counted the number of people here tonight, there's more women here tonight than there are men. That's true almost every even Church of Christ I've ever been to. But in some cultures, it's even greater than that. And I bet a lot of the work that's done. We take a lot of, we put so much emphasis on who leads the prayer or who leads the gives a sermon, and we don't understand the real work, where the rubber meets the road type of work. Is most of it gets done by women. And we need to honor that. We need to bring it out. We need to realize that they're great and they need to see their potential to do what's right with God. They can be teachers. They can do a lot of things. You don't have to teach in an assembly like this in this building. There's plenty of room to teach in China. There's all kind of discussion, I know, in Russia when they went over to Ukraine, when the Russian Soviet Union fell apart. That it became a big issue among some brethren over there about, you know, you have these, you need to translate to a group of people, and the only translator you have is a woman. Can a woman get up and translate for a man? Is she usurping authority? I suppose the man would be usurping authority if you gave the words and they translated what they wanted. That would be wrong. That would be usurping authority. But they're going to say exactly what you say and try to get it across. They're just a servant. They're not going out of line. But anything you see on that screen that you say, well, that's Daryl's work in China, it would never happen if it wasn't for women. Saw even a woman translator, travel women somewhere else. There weren't any men available. She took off vacation work to do it. And did a great job. Anyway, I know our time's up. One more question. Yeah.
I'm just curious. You mentioned earlier that the double agents are the spies that the government would have chosen and mixed in with English. Did you ever
one like the policeman, you mean?
Well,
yeah. Uniform or plainclothes? Well, I'm not so much a plainclothes policeman. However, I am a man of many hats, and I've learned to survive. And it's hard to understand, you know, when you go into a city within 1 year, you can know several hundred people. And they have mates, they have people they know, and I can know what's going on in the police station, let's put it that way, in some cities. I get warnings. I mean, I've escaped the police coming by getting tipped off ahead of time and having 5 minutes on them. That's the kind of thing you face. It's a I could write a book if I wanted to. You can see it's I don't know what to say. wish I did. But as far as, you know, I've converted people who their job was to read other people's email. and to be on the internet and know what dissidents are saying or Christians are saying, or most of the time dissidents, anybody that's going to oppose the government or speaks bad of the government or wants freedom of press or that type of stuff. They locked up 150 journalists in just the last 2 months. I've got pictures on here I don't have time to show you tonight. For some odd reason, all of a sudden...